Hi, I'm Graça. I'm the founder of Human. Actually, it's called Flawed Human, but we use a short name. It's Human. And what is Human? So Human is sort of an emotional revolution company. We help people handle their work lives, and we help companies handle their people. So we provide services, actually. We are an organization which combines the expertise of therapists, coaches, consultants, and we collected the expertise of a medical doctor and a psychologist, and we delivered tailor-made solutions, actually, even a new language, actually, bringing some sort of medical language to companies because of what's happening nowadays, especially with mental health. So we're very concerned with this topic, and Human is radically human, radically empathic, and yeah, we like to embrace vulnerability. Our main philosophy is warm businesses. So what we do is we think people first all the time.
Beautiful. Yeah. Hello, hello, hello. It is so nice to meet you. A mutual friend introduced us, and so I'm very excited to learn a little bit more about the company. But the way that we always introduce the podcast is that in order for us to understand the business, we need to understand the person behind the business. Mm-hmm. So where are you located, and where are you located?
I'm located in Portugal. Right now, I'm in front of the beach. I live in a surf area called Afif. I don't know if you've ever visited Portugal.
I have been to Portugal many, many times. It's one of my favorite places because I work very closely, or at least I used to work very closely with BGI Portugal. So I've been there many times. But I also live in a beachfront, but I live in a sailing community.
Nice.
So looking out my window, I can see the ocean as well. So this is good. We're both enjoying the ocean and nature, which is a good thing. So you're in Portugal. So I would love to know about the start of you. All right, your name is very unique. So we're going to talk about that. But from your childhood to university, tell me that story. Walk us through the story, and also start with how did you get your name?
So my name is a bittersweet story, actually. My name, I'm named after my mother. My mother is also named Graça, which means grace, yeah? But my relationship with my name, I think it was very common for young ladies. I struggled with it a lot. First, because it was my mother's name. Second, because for many reasons. Second, because it was a religious name, which I couldn't identify with. And third, because it was an ancient name. So everything was like, I was rebel, and I was like, what the hell? Like, how am I so unlucky? I have a twin sister, and I think that's very important for me to mention. And her name was also, her name was odd. Her name is Ligia, which you don't meet many Ligias in Portugal either. So I was like, yeah, she's cool. She has a cool name. And then after, you know, many years, and maybe when I'm almost reaching my 40s, I look back and I'm like, oh, no. Okay. How lucky am I to have such a beautiful, graceful name? And, you know, which honors actually something that is very, very important for me, which is traditions and culture. And so I was finally made peace with it. And I also made peace with the love of my mom and her place in my world and my life and my and our interaction. So
I have to sit there and say that I think that's one of the things where, and my mother says it all the time, because I am daddy's girl all the way. Yeah. And I go in the relationship between a mother and a daughter, and my mother reminds me constantly. She goes, it's complicated, it's different, it's unique. When you see the mothers that are best friends, that's great. But I go, the complicated relationships are even more interesting and more unique, because you're trying to find your way and your space with this person that created you, but they're trying to find their space and their way with you as well. And so if you can find that moment of forming a strong relationship with this person, knowing that you guys are dramatically different, I think that right there is a special gift.
That is true. That takes a lot of effort and failed and trial and error attempts, by the way, which was the case with my mother. I felt like I had a stronger responsibility to work on the relationship because I'm a psychologist. So I was like, okay, I think I have more it's actually, the word is responsibility. I am more responsible because I am younger and more equipped to handle these these movements of, you know, egos and all of
well, I think that they were as well at their time. Again, becoming a parent, all the things that you grew up with, all the things that you did, become like protective of what you've created. And because of that, everything that they used to do, they kind of stop. So this is one of those moments where whenever I see friends or things, they're like, I go and they show parents, they have pictures of the parents. Like, my mother used to do this. And they're so shocked that my mother used to wear this. My mother used to do this.
Yeah,
my mother
used to be most smoke. She used to what?
Exactly. And then they stop. And then all of a sudden you're like, you'll never understand. And they giggle it to themselves thinking, you don't even realize how much I understand.
Oh yeah.
And so
I'm not telling you.
Yeah. So I think it's more so once you realize that they're human, and then you find, and then you're at that age where you can actually see them for who they truly are, all of them, not just the parent, the relationship starts to build in a different way. And yes, would you have been friends? I mean, I tell my mother, I love you with all my heart, but I go, if you weren't my mom, I wouldn't be your friend because you're just not the person I gravitate towards. I mean, and so my grandmother, my dad, I love that relationship I'm building with you because you're so dramatically different than anyone I would have ever made friends with. And it makes it, and like you just said, you mature and you get to the point where you're like, okay, I know what I do. And I'm a marketing strategist. I work with people all the time in regards to forming relationships with your team, forming relationships with your co-founder, forming relationships with your target audience. And if I can't do it myself with my mother, then I shouldn't be doing it.
Oh, yeah. Listen, one of the, I'm a trainer also. I train adults with assertiveness and communication. So one of the examples I always provide is my relationship with my mom, especially a tiny deal. There was this one time I have a partner and he mentioned, you know, you're always very polite and empathetic and actually super nice with everybody, but your mom, look at how you answered the phone. Look at how you answered the phone. And I was like, what do you mean? He's like,
other people see.
And then at some point he recorded.
Yeah.
And it was transformative for me.
Yeah. And it's like the whole, like, I always say it's kind of funny. Like, it's like when someone says, I don't snore, I'm like, we have a recording mechanism that I will prove to you that you do snore.
Listen, no, but since that day, from that day on, I gained a violent awareness of how much different I was treating my mom just because of all the, you know, all the cliche things and everything that's related to it. So I actually made a decision from that day on to answer the phone differently and see where the call would take us. And guess what happened?
It changed. 100% it changed. Of course. It really is one of those moments where like you have that moment where like, I am not a rookie. I should have known this. And yet sometimes we forget in our own personal ways. And so need to say, yes. All right. So we're going to pause because we're working now. We're going to go back to you. So, younger you, raised in Portugal, you have one sibling?
No, I have a twin sister and I have an older brother. Okay. My relationship with my older brother is messy. Like many relationships, I guess, but that one is interesting, actually. That's the word I'm choosing at the moment, because he was away from the family for a while and now he's came back, he's returned, and I'm still figuring out the place of things, like the place of the interactions and how much do I actually want to build upon it and build on it, right?
Yep.
With my twin sister, things have been exactly like you imagine. We're twins, but she doesn't look at me like me at all. We're radically different. Our physique, our phenotype is very different. Actually, she's
fraternal twins.
Yeah, and she's taller, much taller than me, and she was always the strong the strong one. And I think I'm still handling and I'm still coping with some of these inner voices regarding to, you know, all the experiences we gathered throughout our childhood. And mom and dad, they were both very entrepreneurial. Mm-hmm. My dad was in the metallomechanic industry in the iron field and all of that. And my mom, she was she's an artist. She doesn't acknowledge she is, but she made fashion clothing and wearables.
Mm-hmm.
And she's I call her the tornado. She's, look, my mom, she's, everybody knows her because I live in a small town. And I think even if it was a big town, she would be very popular because she's a social entrepreneur.
Okay.
And she's always engaged with solidarity and voluntary work. And she finds people homes and she fixes problems, right?
Yep.
And, but then she's very narcissistic and very nosy. So it's like, what's this person? What are you truly doing this for the world or for yourself, woman? And then at some point I was like, yeah, maybe I'm like her too.
And then you're engaging. She's engaging. That's what you are. You guys are engaging people.
Oh yeah. Very much. Very engaged with the community, very engaged with culture. And for me at this point, when I was a teenager, okay, my dad wanted me to be an economist and a manager and work with finance. And I was like, please no, let Ligia do it. So my sister, she is a manager and she works in the commercial field and all of that. And for me, no, I am a psychologist. I obviously took
Wait, before you go into that, did you go to school to be you're born and raised in the town that you're in right now, right?
No. Oh, I moved places.
Okay.
No,
so,
I was
so between where you grew up to where when you started university, is that when you moved or is it you started moving after university?
University was the first hopping exercise, right?
Okay.
Then
okay.
After that, I never went.
Where did you go for to university and what was your major?
My major was psychology.
Okay.
I'm in Porto. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, beautiful city.
Yeah, it's amazing. And that was it. That was the first time I left my parents' house. And then, you know, it was very interesting because at some point I was sure I took the wrong major. I was like, shit.
Why did you feel that you took the wrong major?
Okay, let me put this into context. It was 2006.
Yep.
When I graduated. And I was like, in 2006, in Portugal, there was no demand for psychologists whatsoever. Now I know this is a fallacy. And now I know this is just, you know, I was just bullshitting myself, not trying hard and probably not one.
Wait, we don't cuss on this podcast.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm one of those people where I'm like, I feel we could have a great conversation without cussing.
Yeah, no, that's true. That is very true. But I was like, I was actually coming up with excuses, you know, and I felt like, oh, there's no job, there's no employment for psychologists. And so I quit, actually. Okay. I quit before starting. I quit before actually looking for a job. And it is very ironic.
So you graduated. I mean, let me rewind a little bit. You decided to go this route, but your parents are entrepreneurs. Where did the idea even come from to even do this?
To be a psychologist?
Yeah.
Violence.
Okay.
There was a lot of violence at home.
Okay.
So this history of violence and this history of aggression was definitely the one of the main, motivations for me to understand what's going on. I was sure at some point that I'm sure that this man, my father was very violent. I'm sure that this man loves us.
Yep.
Why is he doing this?
Yeah.
What's going on? Right. And it was very dramatic. It was very dramatic. It was nasty. And it was at points, it was even bloody. So it was like, okay. So I had two options, right? Like when you face such situations, you either run away or you face it, and when you face it, you either face it and become it or you just become resilient and fight it, right? So I went to study psychology because I wanted to understand more than anything, not save my family, not rescue anybody. I just wanted to understand what's going on because I was sure that, for example, my father loved us.
Yeah.
I was also sure that he couldn't show it at all. And I was also sure that there was for sure something extremely painful going on inside him. And I wanted to either help him find out and at least make peace with not hating him. You know, when I was a kid, I remember writing letters to Santa Claus asking for the divorce of my parents. And for many years, I remember this exercise. I never sent those letters anywhere because I was afraid my parents would find them, but I would write them and hide them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know if many people know this, by the way. I'm just sharing this. And okay, so I was like, I was between not really knowing what to do with my life, of course, because when you're a teenager, you're just starting to figure out who you are, especially coming from a, you know, I have this sense of duality because I'm a twin. So it was even more complicated. My sister.
Well, I would even say there's not even just a duality. It's just the fact that you're in the middle. You have your twin, you have a brother, but then you have parents that have a very unique relationship, and it's affecting everyone. It's the ripple effect is affecting everyone in the family. And so I feel that there's more than just dual. There's just like, I mean, you are in this like cylinder of all these different situations and you're like, who am I in this?
No, that's true. And my brother sadly went the wrong path at the time. So he was also violent. So it was not much help. And my sister was very passive. So I think I was the only one left to actually feel like I should do something and could do something. So it was my main motivation, psychology. So my father was very suspicious of my choice at the time. He was like, what do you mean? There's no, you know, it was not part of the family guidelines. Like there was no psychologist in the family. We're builders and we're, you know, maximum, maybe perhaps you could be a doctor or lawyer. Yep. What is that? Right. So I graduated and I did my majors and I started immediately feeling, okay, now I understand a bit more, but there was literally nothing, you know, in Portuguese, that's very interesting. In English, when you're job hunting, you say job hunting. It's actually very, you know, it's active and it's proactive.
Absolutely.
In Portuguese, you know how we say it? We say procurar trabalho, which means to look. Actually, it's like you're with binoculars looking.
You're looking, but you're not seeking it. You're not hunting it.
Oh, exactly. Not at all. So it's a passive modus operandi, right? So I was trapped into those fallacies of, oh, there's not work. And the other side of me was art. I'm a violinist since I'm 9 years old. Uh-huh. And I was like, okay, so I want to be either a psychologist or a violinist. And my parents were laughing. They were, especially my dad. He was like, right, good luck with that.
How are you going to find a job with those two things?
Right. And guess what? Today, that's exactly what I do, right? And so for many years, I felt like this is a dream. I'm insane. I'm never going to make it. And so I decided to go into the public sector working as an employment consultant. Mm-hmm. It was very ironic because I was like, I was drifting away from what I thought it was my dream, or at least not necessarily a dream, because that's an overstatement, but maybe a direction. I felt like, okay, I have a direction. I want art and I want psychology. Yep. And then I was like, oh, but because there's no opportunity, so let me just go work for the government. Here in Portugal, by the way, culturally, it is a good thing to work for the government. It's
absolutely. I have learned that very quickly. Yes.
It's very good for you. Like, you had lots of benefits and all of that. So I had what people said was an amazing job. For me, didn't feel amazing at all. So I spent 7 years working with unemployed people. Actually, I call them misemployed, most of them. Mm-hmm. Even the people who found jobs, they were misemployed. They were just not well placed in their careers. So it came to me, and I think maybe I have helped over 5,000 people find jobs. And it was, and at some point I felt like, okay, so maybe I should be looking for a job.
Isn't that the funniest thing? I mean, like, literally, like, because you're inspiring so many people, you're engaging them. They're so excited. They finally found their dream job because of you. And you're sitting there thinking, that's like a teacher, an educator watches all their students excel. And they're like, why am I not making that money? How come, like, I taught you and you are making like the, your billion, like the, I mean, I always think about Bill Gates. Oh, Bill Gates' teachers, they're he's the richest man in the world, and I taught him, and I'm not. Like, what's going on here?
Listen, what I think, Jodi, is that I think we often teach what we most need to learn.
100%.
Yeah, and that was definitely my case. And my life is very ironic, and I laugh a lot about it, and I cry a lot about it. And it's like, it's very hilarious. And I made peace with it. I made so much peace with it that I only almost 20 years after I graduated, I started my company doing exactly what I want, the way I want it. But for that to be possible, I had to experience lots of things, drift away from what I thought was my direction, explore and play a lot. I use an expression, I say, brincar a vida, which means to play in life, to actually play, you know. So what happened? 7 years into my job as an employment consultant, I decided to go volunteer in Egypt.
I'm going to pause before you even go there. I want, because I always like to stop and make sure that we go back a little bit. While you were in school, so you leave home, you go to Porto, you're in university, you're focusing on psychology, and you meet other students that are in the same field. Did you find that there was a similarity of the students that you were in regards of their home life, in their experiences in life overall? Because it is one of those moments where one of my friends, and she's a psychologist, she said, those that become usually need.
Oh, yeah.
Those that become usually need. So for you, when you're sitting in a classroom of all these students, like you're, this is the first time you've ever left home, and you're thinking, I go, this is like my escape. This is my escape. But now you're in a situation where I can't escape it because I have to like recognize what's gone in my life to, for me to be here right now. So where, what year was it in your university that you realized that you had the aha moment of your dad, your aha moment of your mom and your siblings? And then you're looking around, you're like, wait, they're all having ahas, or are they? So was that weird for you? How was that situation of being away from home and in that setting?
Right. It wasn't actually during the majors. It was during my post-graduation where I decided to go into the crime, the criminal psychology field. I did an specialization in criminal psychology and forensic psychology because obviously I was very connected to deviant behavior and all of that. And then once there, I was writing some papers and publishing some papers, and that there was this... I was a speaker, a keynote speaker at a conference, and people asked me personal questions. So I started sharing my story, and my colleagues, we went to have lunch, and they were like, okay, so I think it's time for us to share our stories. And then that was like, right. So that's there's a reason we're all here. Right. And it could be because, there is always some sort of inclination, some sort of invitation, right? Your call, there's a calling for our decisions, at least for me. I'm a very intuitive person. So I always try to read what's calling me, like what's calling me to this place, what's calling me to this person, right? So yeah, there was a couple of people who took the opportunity or embraced my vulnerability in ways that was very caring. So we built it from then on. And it was beautiful. I remember I cried that night. it was nice. And then what happened was after that, so it wasn't really an aha moment. My first aha moments were before college. They were, so at the age of 11, me and my sister, my parents, they weren't very educated when it comes to, they weren't much educated. They both had, like, you know, it's called here the fourth year, which is like primary education only. But they were social smart. So they both put me and my sister, they took us to this place. And that place was very transformative for me. That place was some sort of association, an NGO, now it's an NGO, in Algarve. I don't know if you know the region. And my parents were like, okay, so you're both going on a vacation to the Algarve. And we were like, okay, that's exciting because, you know, the beach and sand and ice cream. And we were 11, right?
Just the two of you or the entire family?
No, just the two of us. They sent us to that project. It was a pilot.
Okay. There
was an NGO which was starting, and my parents, my father went to war with this man, his friend, and his friend was like, so there's a person I know who's building an inclusive experimental project in the Algarve, and so you should let your kids go. My kids are going. So my father, I don't know what happened. He had this moment and he trusted his friend and he sent us away. And it was like a whole month in the Algarve. And I thought, you know, on the way there, me and my sister, we were like, okay, so fun. It's fun. It's going to be amazing because we're going on vacation. But then something very funny happened. We were in a big van with lots of kids and everybody was very excited because everybody knew each other except me and my sister, a couple of other kids. And as we were arriving at the beach, we thought like, that's it. We're there, right? It's over. It's Portugal ends there, right? And then the truck just turned around the bus just turned around and started climbing the mountain. And we're like, what? Weren't we going to the beach? So no, we went on a retreat for a whole month in the mountains. We had a sea view, but it was in the mountains. It was in Monchique. So what was there? What did we do? We did all sorts of, for me, it was very unique. Everything was very new. Like we did recycling at the time. We did meditation, yoga, all sorts of spiritual experiences. And it was like, oh, what is this? What kind of witchcraft is this? And of course, my father had no idea that was going on. He thought it was like, you know, sports oriented and all of that. And it wasn't. It was oriented to handcrafts and to psychology and to, you know, finding yourself, finding.
I have a question. Oh, my God. Do you think that your father's friend knew your father's persona and said, you know what? I want to sit there and have these girls have this moment. I mean, wait. And also, I want to know why your brother didn't go. But do you think that your father's friend just saw something? They were like, you know what? I need to do something to help. And I don't want to engage my friend and get him mad, but I want to do something that will help not only him and his kids, but also maybe all these other people he knew.
Maybe 10 years ago, I had a conversation with my father's friend and he confessed it was on purpose. Like he was very aware of the situation. So I owe it to him a lot. And it was, I know there is a before and after that experience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so we were 11 and we kept on going every year.
So for how many years did you go?
Nine.
Nice.
Yeah. So psychology was, you know, like they actually helped me, for example, in my case, they actually helped me, you know, foster my creative side and my investigative side and all of that. And they also, once a year, they recharged me with confidence that I could go somewhere and do something. So I have a very close relationship with the NGO owner up to this day. And she's 70 at the moment. We're beautifully close. There were such visionary people. They were the first NGO to do this kind of experiment in the Algarve. Back then, it was 30 years ago. Yeah.
So, and are you friends with, I mean, are you still friends with kids that went to the camp?
Oh yeah. Very close.
I think that's one of the things where I tell people all the time, children that go to camp versus children that do not, they don't understand how quickly it is you can make a friend and really be engaged, because I could be friends with my next door neighbor and I'm friends with them. Like I go and I grew up with them and we play together and we know everybody, we're neighbors. But when you go to camp, that whole entire experience of living, it's dramatically different.
Yes.
It's unexplainable unless you've gone to camp.
Right. The first time I was starting to be, the first time people started speaking about Big Brother experience, I was like, I know that feeling. I know it, because it's exactly like that. Right. So we're in a place with no, at points there was even no electricity. So we had to do everything. We had to, and there was this exercise that really changed me. There was this one time we were there, we were kids, and the trainer, the monitor, he told us, okay, so today we're going to do an inclusive and diversity experience. Mm-hmm. Well, it was 30 years ago. So we had to, the whole day, we were blindfolded.
Nice. And I say nice because I know what that means, because to be in someone else's shoes and not be able to like, how do you function and how all your other senses come full frontal because you're lost one.
That's so, it was dramatic for me. It was beautiful. And because we had one of the attendees, he was blind. So it was an empathy exercise, right?
Yep.
So when I say radical empathy, I do. I actually build radical empathetic experiences with my trainings and with my people and with my employees and with my community and with everything that I am involved with, because I was so immersed in that sensation. I was like, okay, so this helps, right? Once you feel it, you're going to find in the future ways to revisit that place of
always.
So it was amazing. So that place was incredible. But the fact that my father trusted us into that place, my father never
trusted his friend.
Right.
Trusted his friend. Because I think that's one of the things where his friend saw something he knew probably that his friend saw something and he's like, you know what? I'm going to let you help me help me.
Oh yeah. And you know, there's one thing that I didn't tell you about. It was finally after graduation, after, you know, psychology entered my life and I felt like I'm not really a psychologist. I'm not a psychotherapist. That's what I've been telling my life the whole time. And of course not anymore, but for many years after graduation, I was like, I'm not a psychotherapist. I'm a psychologist. Yeah. And then people were like, what does that mean? And I was came up with excuses again because I was very afraid, you know, the imposter syndrome and lots of limiting beliefs and all of that. Mm-hmm. And at some point, so I decided to, because I'm an artist and I like music so much, and music is actually a big dimension in my life. It's one of my other personas. I decided, okay, so how about I try a career in music, right? Yep. And music or in art, actually. So mm-hmm. that's when, after college and after spending like 6 months or so trying to find a job that was, you know, directed and aligned with what I wanted and not finding one because yep. of the binocular approach and not yep. the bow and elbow approach, right?
Yep.
So I worked for the government and then I had an amazing job. It was very well paid. I was living very close to work. So everything seemed it was working. Like people didn't really understand. And I also didn't understand. But then I realized, okay, so I'm going to volunteer. I'm going to Africa. Yep. So that's what I did. And then the first 4 months I was working at a school. It was a Montessori school. Mm-hmm. I was working
in Egypt.
In Egypt, in Alexandria, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, okay, so I came to the conclusion that there are many sides of me. My life has never been a one-way road, and let's go. Let's play life again. Mm-hmm. So I was always starting over. I have a feeling that I've never stopped starting over. And even today, even yesterday, I was taking a shower and I was like, so maybe I should start over with something. And I was like, and this is, it means something. It means like I have more wings than roots. Maybe yep. I should start letting those roots settle, right? Because mm-hmm. I'm 40 and like, you know, I'm not a mom and that's because of it, right? So there yep. are consequences to this exploration of life. There are consequences. Mm-hmm. And then I'm still working with my therapist and because a good therapist has a therapist.
So I've heard many times. Yep.
Yeah. So I'm working with trying to actually figure out and gain clarity around, okay, what about this, right? What actually do I want? Do I want to continue moving because I'm very fast paced, or do I want to experience for the first time, maybe slow living, maybe, you know, settling and all that. Okay. So I went to Egypt, and in Egypt, I was, you know, with ISAC, the International Association with University Students.
Okay.
And I went there to teach English for kids and all of that in the Montessori approach. I really loved it. I made incredible friends in that community. I always loved education because I think that educators are irreversible change makers if they want to. Mm-hmm. Right. So I was working with that school. And then at some point the internship finished and I decided I'm not going back. I'm just going to work with art.
Yeah.
And so I worked with art for 8 years in Egypt, and okay. it was beautiful.
When you say art, is this going back to your violin, or is this actually like hands-on paint, acrylics, mass media? What is that in art?
Oh yeah, I was working with music, so my violin, and also managing a few bands, working on promotions and of concerts and festivals and all of that, okay. and production of all sorts of film, and especially music, mainly music. But also I was the assistant director of an international festival for contemporary circus and street art. Mm-hmm. And it was beautiful because it happened during the Arab Spring. So, you know, Cairo was under civil war, and there still isn't today, but there at that point there was obviously no governmental budget for art,
right,
or education. It was
always so unfortunate, because when there's a war, when there's tax cuts or just cuts to a budget, the first thing that they take away are sports and arts.
Yeah, I know. That's very true, Jody.
But and mentally, those are the things that people go towards when, like, I mean, because like in Japan and China, in Japan, they have a very high suicide rate and people go to work and they do what they're told. And so innovation is there, but it's not part of their jobs. But when you think about where the music and Tai Chi and like all their sports and look, their love for costumes, that is all innovation and creativity, and yet they don't come together. And so when I see it being pulled away from schools and pulled away from countries and pulled away from jobs, I'm like, what are you doing? Because that's people's outlets.
That's true. And that is very true. And when it comes to expression mainly, because what I saw during those 8 years, it was like, I think it was maybe 2 years, we had curfews every day, right? We had tanks on the street, we had bombs, we had all sorts
of... And wait, what year was this?
2011. It was the Arab Spring. It was the coup d'état, right? Yeah. It was exactly...
Can you imagine, that's 2011. It wasn't that far. It wasn't that long ago.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And I was living in downtown in Talat Had, which is the main street right next to Midan al-Tahrir, which is the street where the revolution happened, like mm-hmm. symbolic place for the revolution. And at that time, I felt like, okay, so now I have a mission, right? So I'm going to bring, so I integrated that project mm-hmm. and it was very emotional for me at that moment, because the leader of the project was a woman, which is very intense in the Muslim country, and now I can say this, I think I can say this, although it's quite tricky, but I think I'm going to say it, her assistant was gay, which is obviously wrong in a Muslim country, and not for us, but for the, you know, the society.
Not that it's wrong, but it's not accepted.
No, it's actually punished.
It's not accepted. I mean, lots of countries don't accept it. And so thus there's laws against it, but it's like, it's not accepted.
Not accepted at all. It was very dangerous and all of that. So the core of the project was two women and him, right? And I felt like, okay, so now we're making a difference. We're empowering women. We're empowering the diverse community, and we're bringing people joy. So the project is called actually the Joy Project, and it was a long. It still exists, right? I just left the country because my father had cancer, so I felt like I had to return home, but the project's still there, and it's the festival. Was an incredible opportunity to bring to the Alexandrians and Cairns top of the world artists, you know, when it comes to, you know, circus artists especially, and all kinds of shadow acts and troops from Germany and troops from China and troops from the Philippines and all of that. And we were doing it. We were doing the public service the government wasn't doing, right? Mm-hmm. And I felt like, I have a mission. I have a place. I'm bringing people happiness. And at some point, I realized whilst there, I started organizing workshops and all of that. And the theme was always mental health and happiness. Mm-hmm. So I felt like, oh, there's my psychology creeping in.
So now this is definitely a moment of, okay, it's everything that I've experienced and everything I've talked about is falling together. It's like being put in place. So talk to me about how did the business develop from that moment? Like, so what, I mean, you came back because your dad had cancer, but is that when you started the company, or did you start the company in Europe? I'm sorry, in Egypt.
No, I started a company here. I started a company less than a year ago.
Okay.
And it was here, and it was okay. So I returned. Meanwhile, in the last years of Egypt, right, I managed, not me, the whole family, I managed to build a psychologically safe space for everybody. Mm-hmm. And my father started to finally opening up and apologizing and being honest and being open and transparent. And I had to coach myself and coach my sister and my mother to be facilitators for that change, because it's very tempting to, once you've been victimized, it's very tempting to just block the person when they try to, you know, fix things and make amends, right? And
do you think that was because he had cancer or something else happened?
He didn't have cancer at the time when he started the change process. There was, though, an incident that probably, probably triggered it, which was my grandfather died, his father.
Yeah.
And I think this, I can associate that, his change to that moment.
Yeah.
And everything started. And also on top of that, right after, the first grandchild was born, and there was lots of emotional opportunities to bond, yeah, right? And also trauma. So trauma helps people bond too. It's like the perfect setting for a change.
Yes.
And then he was diagnosed with cancer, and then we all really came together, and now we have, actually, we live a very healthy family atmosphere, and my father especially, he's a very different man, and it was...
But the thing is, you guys all work towards that. You guys, all it would take is one person to say, nope, nope, nope. That would
be my brother.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the only thing that is still missing in the puzzle is, like, I still have to work with my brother on that aspect, for example, mm-hmm, right? So I'm still working on it. And it's not a priority, to be frank. I'm focused on other things, but I know that it's in the back of my head. I know I have to do it. And I am, again, the most equipped person to do it, that's for sure. But he has to want it, right? And he
absolutely.
I think he wants it, right? I think he wants it because he started, love is contagious. Mm-hmm. Love is absurd.
100%.
Yeah. So once we started, finally being more honest, more open, and more caring with each other, he was shocked at the moment, because our family was totally drift apart for many, many years, for decades. Yeah. So when my brother, for example, experienced this, he didn't know what to do with it, what to make of it, right? So this, it's building, it's building, yep, it's growing into him, yeah. So I returned from Portugal and I had no plan at all. I had a career, right? 8 years is enough to build a career. So I was an art director or an artist.
Well, at this point, there's two careers, because 7 years in government, but then 8 years in Egypt. Yeah. So you're invested in everything that you're going to. You're fully invested. So it's not like you're like that 2 years and out kind of a person. Oh, no. You are literally where 7 years and 8 years is a big, you've made a big change wherever you are. Yeah.
And also in Egypt, the last years, I was also a teacher. I teach the violin. Okay. So I had lots of students. I had over 40 students, mm-hmm, and it was like, I didn't have a school or anything. It was like private practice. So at some point I was like, okay, so this is not working. It's too much people. I want to have free time for other things. But then there was this one student, which I think also set the mark for me. It was like a milestone because of one thing she told me. She told me, I told her, I'm sorry, I think I'm going to have to stop with the lessons because I want to focus on other things and the festival and other things. I want to have more time. And she was like, okay, so maybe we can stop with the lessons, but can we not stop with the therapy? And I looked at her, I was like, what therapy? She was like, because you give me music therapy. I was like, no, it's music lessons. And she was like, no, half of the lesson, we're discussing psychology and we're talking about ways to figure out, ways out and how to understand myself and my family and my workplace. Mm-hmm. And I helped lots of people. I only worked with adults, and all of them were in periods of their lives where they were running their bucket list. That's because they need to. Okay, so there's plenty of poverty, right? So people who actually could afford to learn the violin with a foreigner and pay those prices were actually people who were already well established in their lives, right?
Mm-hmm. But
most of them, and I mean most of them, the majority of them weren't happy with their careers. So I actually, what I knew how to do best, which was, okay, so let me help you out, right? Mm-hmm. Let's run a diagnosis. Let's see which profile you have. Let's see which options do you have. And we started exploring that, right?
Yeah.
So it was like, they would come to the violin lessons and get out with maybe quite an added value, right?
Yep.
So at some point I stopped with the violin lessons because I was also not getting not much pleasure out of it, but I was getting pleasure out of the humans. Yes.
Out of humans.
So this student, she told me, can we continue this and I'll pay you for therapy? And I was like, I'm not a psychotherapist. Like, no, because I'm not a psychotherapist. You need to go see someone who's an expert, right? And she was like, you've already helped me.
Yeah.
And she mentioned it. She was like, okay, so you helped me doing this and this and this and this, right? So I came to Portugal with that in mind. And it was, you know, bittersweet. It was very emotional and all of that. And then in Portugal, I had no plan at all. I didn't know what to do.
Yep.
So I went the first few months, I was only, you know, working as a consultant or a trainer here and there, mm-hmm. because people knew my work, right? Because I worked here for 7 years. And
well, I'm going to pause you because like, I definitely want to be very mindful of time. You come back to Portugal, you've had these experiences, but you come back to Portugal during the pandemic.
No, I came back to Portugal precisely a few months before it hit. It
exploded. What month?
I came in August. The pandemic hit in
2019. March. So August 2019. Okay. Yes. So because I just want to get the timing of things. So you come back and you're taking on consultant work. You're doing things. So you're the business itself. When did the business start?
A year ago. Less than a year ago.
Less than a year. So in the pandemic.
In the
during
pandemic.
That time. So like you come back August 2019. The pandemic starts and you're still trying to figure out where I am and what I'm doing. Pandemic starts in March 2020, and then you decide to start a business, which of course makes me always so happy when someone starts something during a downward turn economy or during a massive world-changing moment.
Yes.
Why? What did you notice? Because I mean, obviously we're seeing how a lot of people were not designed to be at home. A lot of people were not designed. I mean, I love the pandemic. Healthy-wise, I was always healthy. But I loved it because I was never allowed to go out when I was younger. So I was like, I was designed for this. But a lot of people were not designed to be at home. A lot of people were not designed to be on Zoom. A lot of people were not designed to not have interactions with people. A lot of people, as you could see, divorce rates are extremely high because the world was a buffer. I'm going to go to the gym. I'm going to go with girlfriends. I'm going to go to the So they always had an escape from their spouse that they married, that they loved. But when they were with them, their spouse for a whole year that they could not leave, they realized this is not the person that I want to be with. So you are creating an atmosphere for the humans. Yes. You are watching the humans, not just locally, but globally. What, how did it define your brand new business in a pandemic? You're watching the humans and you're seeing how a lot of them are not the strongest people you could possibly meet did not do well. How did that assess your business right now?
Well, I was aware during those years that the pandemic, I was a trainer into careers. So guess what? Like that was challenging, right? I had to help people find jobs during the pandemic. And they were like very unmotivated and very defeated when they came to me, right? So I told them, guys, this is the best time to apply for a job. Because that's when nobody else is applying, right? So please, even if the job is not happening at the moment, make yourselves seen right now, because you're going to be the only lunatic actually attempting this. So the company will notice you and you're going to get that job when once the company, starts, rolling. And that worked for over 1,000 people. And then I was like, okay. And then people always started requesting me and asking for career advisory and all of that. And so I thought there is a demand for this, right? So of course the pandemic accelerated the issue about mental health. And with that came the great resignation. And during those years, we actually observed finally people voicing what they always felt, right? They're no longer afraid to share their pains and move on, right? So this is a huge burden for people and companies, but of course it translates into increased financial costs, but mainly it demonstrates people are no longer, they won't put up with it anymore. So now they spend less time doing things they don't like to do. So there's a greater demand for people to have to find out, okay, so what would be the kind of atmosphere I would work in that I would be glad to go to, even if the effort, I have to make an effort to rearrange my work dynamics, even if I have to do it on Zoom calls. Jody, I myself hated video calls. I hated video calls. This is my life today.
It's so funny because there's so many professors around the world that left their jobs. These are the reasons why students went to these universities for these professors. And when they had to go on Zoom, they're like, nope, I'm leaving. I'm taking early retirement.
Yeah. But then again, once you're faced with a situation, you have to figure out which person are you going to be? Are you going to be the person who tries and says, oh, it doesn't work for me? Or are you going to be the person who says it doesn't work for me without even actually attempting? Mm-hmm. So I'm never going to be the person who doesn't try. I'm always going to be the person who tries, right? I face my discomforts and fears with proactivity. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, I am afraid of flying. And when
you went to Egypt.
I flew over 20 times a year alone by myself. I am afraid of swimming and I just enrolled in swimming classes, right? So this is it. I mean, this is what I try to do.
Well, the thing is, I feel like you have one life, and in that one life, and mind you, whether you live to 10 years old or whether you live to 110 years old, you have one life. And if you limit yourself, what's the point?
That's so true. I always, there's one thing that I do with my career advisory training or upskilling programs. I start asking the question, do you believe in reincarnation? And some people, of course, say yes. And I was like, you are so lucky because I think I only have one opportunity here. Mm-hmm. So I do that thing, you know, the stoic approach to, you've seen that infograph where you count the weeks you've lived and the ones you have left, mm-hmm. considering the estimated time of living, right? The estimated time of the life expectancy.
Okay.
So I do this infograph for human, for the company. And I actually gave it to a friend of mine. It was like, okay, so you're now, for example, 36 years old. So this is the number of weeks you've lived. You spent these weeks doing this job or engaging in this activity. Are you happy?
Or waiting in line.
Or waiting in line, yeah. And now from this moment on, from today on, we think we don't have a chance. We think that because we've built a path that we have to continue on that path.
Yep.
We don't.
Yeah.
We seriously don't. So, okay, what do you want to try? Do you want to continue not trying? Do you want to try something, right? So this is what we do. My main focus with human, for example, is about misemployment. Mm-hmm. It's warming up businesses so that the orientation is towards the people, right? Companies and leaders start consciously focusing on their people, which wasn't happening since the Industrial Revolution, of course. And I don't mean to be saying the cliches that everybody knows.
No, but it's true because this is like, so for me, in regards of the marketing that I do, people are like, I go, well, how do you approach marketing? I'm like, well, I don't care about your service. I don't care about your product. I don't care about your brick and mortar building. I care about the people in your business, because leadership, your team, as well as your target audience, if they are not engaged, if they are not empowered, they literally will not buy your product, and they will go online on Sundays. Oh my God, I hate going to work. I mean, all that negativity is going to hurt your business. So why not take care of the human beings? And it starts from what you're doing to get them engaged to find the right job.
That is so true, because we're going to spend an average of 80,000 hours working, right? It's over 60% of our lives. And of course, me as a psychologist, I could be focusing on impacting people on many dimensions of their lives, but why not using psychology? And by the way, within Ish, with my partner, using and with the whole approach of human, business model, approach humans and promoting mental health and physical health, right? Mm-hmm. And how to do that? First, start diagnosing whether this person actually fits there. Yeah. And what does that mean? It means like, listen to the phrase, if this person actually fits there, if there is a fit, if it's there that the person fits, and if this is the right person for that position and that company and those values and all of that, right? We don't acknowledge that. We attract, as business owners, we attract people not minding the importance of sharing who we are as a company. Because if I play my true colors and if I show my true colors to the community I operate in, the people who are going to come to me and say, can I work for you? Can I work with you? Right? Mm. It's not for you. It's with you. Mm. they're not going to work with me because if they know that I'm not very businesslike. So, so I'm going to attract people who actually already know. So I'm more transparent with in my business. I am more transparent. I am very unbusinesslike. I am radically human, and I believe in do good and be rich.
Well, I'll give you, I want to get your perspective on this. I mean, obviously you're watching how not only it definitely was more reported here in the United States, but now we're seeing it everywhere where highly educated individuals highly educated individuals that are getting paid more than six figures or high six figures are walking away from these jobs, walking away. So in respects to the individual that one assumes, I went to medical school, I went to engineering school, I went to law school, I did my MBA, I have this like the dream job, I'm working at a consultant firm, et cetera. And then during the pandemic, they realized this is not the life that I want for myself. And they walked away. These schools, these jobs did their jobs in regards of getting the right person in, training them to answer the questions, making sure this is the right career trail for you. And then the pandemic happened and everyone's confused in regards of what happened. We don't understand because everyone did their jobs to make sure that this was a perfect match, but they didn't anticipate a pandemic because we never had one. Well, we had one 100 years ago. So what happened? Because people are trying to figure it out now. Like years from now, we're going to find out in university, but right now, what in your opinion, what do you think happened where everyone did their jobs? The pandemic came in and then all of a sudden we're like,
I think it's because the matching was made, the barometer for the matching was made on skill set and not on values and personality and character, right? People are leaving their workplaces because not due to salary, not due to work conditions, due to human reasons. They leave their jobs because of their bosses mainly. Gallup has plenty of data on this, right? It's the reason why most people are leaving, especially highly educated people, especially those ones, is because of the people.
The micromanager had no power at home.
Right. And, you know, like this phenomenon of helicopter management, like actually trying to control and it's actually a helicopter. It's literally like that, right? Yeah. So it is. People are not, they don't put up with that anymore. They finally, because, you know, with the pandemic, there was an interesting phenomenon, which was before the pandemic, your biggest fear was the unknown, especially with career, regarding to career. Mm-hmm. With the pandemic came the fear of death, came the fear of dissembling your family, of not knowing what to expect from a world. It was a zombie mentality, right?
Yep.
It was the apocalypse mentality. So that puts things into perspective, obviously. So people started to finally acknowledging there are bigger fears than not having a job, not having a salary. I'm going to make it. I have a good transferable skill set and I'm a doctor, so I could be an engineer because there's plenty of compatibility between that profile and this one, right? Mm-hmm. So I think what's happening is this, is that the mix match was built upon skills, and that is so irrelevant.
Yeah, it is. What is your prediction for the future? Because there are a lot of jobs that have openings. I mean, I've never seen, if you're telling me you can't find a job, you're not looking, because there are so many people that are paying obscene amount of money to get people to even come through the door to apply, to have an interview. What's your prediction of what happens in the next 2 to 3 years? Because we see where we're going right now. A lot of people weren't working hybrid. I can work anywhere at any time. I just came back from Guadeloupe, where I was working in Guadeloupe for a month. So what is your prediction in regards of the way that people are hiring? Because I feel that anyone that's going to get the most out of this interview are definitely human resources, HR, because they are struggling. They used to have so much power in a company, and now they're struggling. So what do you think happens next?
Listen, I think that the HR field is struggling because this is very inconvenient, and I am a business owner myself, so it is inconvenient for everybody, right? So it's because we were doing things wrong. What does that mean? It means that We weren't attracting people with honesty. We weren't handling our resources with our human resources with honesty. For example, recruitment is not only opening a job vacancy, posting it online, see if there's a candidate. No, even the job vacancy itself, even the ads for the job has to add, you have to put a lot of much more work into it, right? You have to be more transparent. You have, as business owners and as HR managers or professionals, you have to spend a lot of time digging into what's the profile that I'm looking for. If you do that right, that job right, the right candidates or the right sort of candidates will approach you. Once they approach you, you have to have more tools. People have to be more specialized, especially HR professionals. Most of the ones that I know and I've met a lot, they're not specialized. What does it mean? They don't know how to profile. They don't acknowledge, they don't include these measurements. Like the only focus is on skills. For example, during interviews, people don't know how to interview. They don't invite you to be at your best during the interview. They create an atmosphere of fear.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there because that right there makes me, I love that because, so I'm going to call you out on a word that you use that I'm anti. Okay. So you use imposter syndrome. Yeah. And I call it an MTV word because it's just, it's a fad. It's a word that's a fad. And I call it out because how do you allow one to be their true self if these words are coming around and people can't be themselves because now they're like, what is that? In the years past, people would go and there'd be an authentic conversation, not an interview, but a conversation in regards of, this is what my needs are. This is what your skills are. Who are you as a person and how will you elevate my company? And that's why people stayed in companies for 20 years, 25 years. They'd get their gold watch of retirement after, et cetera. Then we started becoming extremely unauthentic, passing around business cards, et cetera. I go, why is the man, I mean, the business schools, they teach you to answer questions like, why is the manhole round? Does it matter why the manhole is round? Does it matter? Because how is that question going to help me in your company or my skill sets? So now all these games are out there. All these words are thrown out. So how does one expect to show their true selves if they're constantly being taught these silly things to get bypassed an HR person because they're only going to check, they're rating you off of the way you answer these weird things that's not relevant to a job or a career. So please bring that up because for me, that's what I have to combat where whenever someone comes to me, they're like, they've erased me. I'm a human being. I know a skill set. I come from a great family. I come from an amazing culture and I'm being erased by answering questions that I'm, why is the manhole round? Or that I'm an imposter where I'm like, I was raised to be this very, very authentic person. And now they're planting these seeds of imposter syndrome in my head. So how do we advance humans if we're constantly playing these games with them?
I think the solution is, I think they're doing us a favor. Every time that we're being erased, this is very controversial. Every time I'm being erased, I think that this is an opportunity for me to filter. So that's not the company I want to work for.
100%. But you even used the word. And I was like, I don't understand. Why are you giving power to a word?
I intend to give extra power to any word, just like I use other words and it don't feel empowered or more relevant than others, right? Yeah. I think it's to do with context, right? In this sense. For me, the imposter syndrome, when I used it, yeah, it's because it's an actual phenomenon we study in psychology. It's not void, it's not empty. It's just that businesses took that and applied it and they're
giving it power.
Yes, they're giving it power, but I'm a psychologist, right? So for me, yeah, things have a different sense of wordings are very words. This is my object of work, yeah, right? So there is an actual imposter syndrome in me, but it's a syndrome in me. Yeah. It's like people say, oh, I'm depressed. No, you're not OCD. You're not depressed, right? So
Or they could be. We don't know. They could be.
Yeah, but then I would know, right?
Yeah. Right, because of your role. So as a marketing strategist, my biggest thing is, so when the word first came up, I'm like, where did it come from? And I had my interns look it up, and it literally was developed off of a TV show on MTV. And then someone wrote a book off of it. And I'm like, I go, we have so many more things to worry about, and giving power to. And so I, whenever someone, one of my clients come to me, or when I'm mentoring, I'm like, we're too busy. We're too busy to get involved in these words. Can we focus, please? And they're like, oh, right. Cause I call them out because I need you to focus on the task at hand. And task is to make someone else's life better because of what you created. And so that's why I'm like, when we are in the world of HR, people are like, oh, no imposter syndrome, no this. I'm like, well, how does one enjoy being in a job when they're constantly being marked by a person that probably isn't the best interviewer?
Again, that's a challenge. That's a challenge. But then about the future, answer your question. The future will belong to companies who revolutionize their ways of handling people in 360 degrees way. Yeah. From the way they post job ads to the way they actually conduct interviews, which means, for example, not really asking, give me a couple of examples of when you showed organization. No. I'm going to give you a work sample. Yeah. I'm going to invite, but what's the problem with this approach is that it's going to require more time. Yeah, so I'm going
exactly.
to and time in business, you know, time is, it's tricky because time is actually very highly monitored. So for example, us at Human, time is what we do. We do things slowly. Everything we do things slowly. And this is contrary to the pacing and the rhythm of the world. Mm-hmm. But then the pandemic came for a reason, right? So it showed us that our rhythm was wrong. So we have to do things slowly. Yeah. We have to look at each person. That is almost absurd from a business point of view. We have to look at each person and see, okay, I'm going to spend not an hour, not 45 minutes, but I'm going to spend a lot of money and a lot of time figuring out who you are, helping you discover who you are. Mm-hmm. And then as a recruiter, I'm not going to necessarily assign you to this job posting. I'm going to assign you to that project makes more sense for you, right?
Yeah.
So I need to start looking at the profiles of my people. And once that first phase of recruitment is done, I'm going to have to work on the next one, which is onboarding properly. Yeah. If I onboard this person properly, accepting holistically his full dimension as a human being, I'm going to accept that he, even during the negotiation with, you know, contracts and with and negotiating salaries and negotiating compensation, the compensation itself is a big deal. It's a huge issue. Why should you want me to compensate with money if what I want and privilege is time? If I'm recently a mother, if I just gave birth to a child, I don't want $100 or $300 extra. I want time. Even at 4:30. And if I'm a recent graduate, I don't want maybe time. I want you to help me build on my skills and probably give me training. But if I bought a house in the last 6 months, I could use the money. So we have to sit with each person and negotiate. It's about time.
The handicap to a lot of companies are human resource. So, so you have the CEOs, founders, leadership, C-suite, you have the employees, you have this person or team of human resources, and they're getting training, they're doing this, but still there's that problem of, I mean, it's not like a new problem. It's been this ongoing problem. There are some phenomenal human resource people out there, but the numbers are low, super crazy low. So what advice would you give to a C-suite, a leadership, an innovator, the lead in regards of bringing on a person that can help them? Like, what are the number one priorities and characteristics of the person that will build your team that you'd give, like two or three of them?
My answer is going to be controversial, I think.
I'm a big fan of, and controversial for me is not controversial. I mean, this is your opinion, your thoughts.
It's exactly, this is my opinion. And this is how I operate with, how we as at Human, we operate with this mindset. I don't think that the problem starts in HR, even if you have a C-suite leadership or C-suite board of directors. I think that if your HR responsible isn't minding, if his or her work isn't working, if people are leaving, it's not the HR. It's the leadership. I'm sorry, but it's the leadership. So you can be amazing as a leader and, you know, like saying that you want to empower your people and to give freedom and to explore creativity and provide diversity and all of that. But if, for example, you want to sell freedom but you spend 12 hours a day at the office, you're signaling out a different contradictory message, right? Yep. You're actually saying, I value the time you spend at the office.
Yep,
so, right. So I think that if the HR personnel isn't skilled, expert, mostly because they're not motivated, mm-hmm. it's because of the leadership.
Yeah. Or it's not even just motivated, scared. They're scared. One of the things one of the things that when people come to me in regards to their personal branding, it's usually because they're like, I have no power to do what I know is right because I'm afraid to leave my job. I'm afraid to lose my job.
That's for sure. And that is a valid fear, by the way. But then you just trace it back again to leadership.
Yeah.
So I think again, this is.
So what advice would you give in regards to what are one or two steps that leadership can do to alleviate this problem?
They need to talk more to their people. They need to speak more. It's not just leadership, humans in general. We need to speak up. We need to talk more. Yeah. And we need to have the courage, even if it's as a leader, for example, I can't be an accidental leader. What does that mean? Like I can't be the person who's very nice and very engaging when I happen to pass in the corridor by a coworker or a colleague or a subordinate and say, hey, by the way, how's it going?
Yeah.
That's nothing. That is just an accident, right? I bumped into him. So I take the opportunity to ask, how is it going? Yeah. That is not enough.
Yeah.
Real conversations, they start from the leader.
Right.
So he has to take the initiative. I think that leaders and the HR, the focus has to be on conversation, on dialogue. I think it's radically simple. It's not easy. You know, sometimes we mistake simple with easy. For example, if I want to cross a river shore to the other side and there is a thread or a line or a rope across it, right? It is simple. All I have to do is balance myself and use the rope and cross it to the other side. But that's not easy. It's just simple, right? So here is the same thing. So it's simple. Talk more. Actually put time box your agenda to speak. Actually spend time or time box your agenda to look out the window and hear the noise in your head. Right. It's not just, okay, so we have a meeting to analyze performance, or we have a meeting to analyze or a meeting with the stakeholders. How about your people?
Yeah, 100%. I couldn't agree with that even more, because I think that's one of the reasons why I do. Like, I mean, we're in the same world where we care about the people so much. And during the pandemic for me, it was literally the world was in a petri dish and I'm just like observing. And I'm just like watching how people are like, some people did great, some people didn't do great. And I was like, this is fascinating. It's absolutely the best case study in my life was during the pandemic, and how people, the most highly intelligent people, the people that were like elevating themselves from not getting the education that they wanted to, but now they're like finally having a moment to take for themselves. I mean, the Petri dish was amazing. It was amazing.
That's true.
Two more questions for you. I have the last question, but then I have one more thing where full circle in regards of everything that you've done. How did the pandemic, create, evolve your business? Hmm. Okay. Knowing it's a new business, but your past, your family, I go your experiences, and now where you are right now with the pandemic. Still, we're still in a pandemic, but we're in the tailor end of it. Yes. So how did everything full circle come to creating this business, and how are you feeling about it right now?
Okay. I'm very, very hopeful about it. I think it is very promising. So this is an organization. This isn't a company. I look at Human not as a company, but as an organization. And it's not. I'm not playing the finite game. I'm playing an infinite game. If you're comfortable, if you're familiar with the Simon Sinek's approach, so I'm playing. So what does it mean? It means that I'm pretty much 100% sure. This is very rare for me to say such things, but I am 100% sure that the future is going to be focused on humanity. The businesses have to shift, otherwise they will fall in every sector, in every industry. And I'm not worried about technology. I think technology, as long as there are humans like me and like you who put themselves out there and who struggle, they're going to stop the bad things and try to, you know, there's always going to be a struggle, but this, we're going to be very active into conducting technology in order to service and to not service, to dignify us at least, right? And protect the planet. There is a big concern about that. The pandemic itself was an opportunity for me to look out the window, which isn't an activity that there is much prestige in doing, right? So like, if it's like, especially for me, I'm a fast-paced human, a fast-paced woman. And I always have the sense that my time is limited. So I have to work as much as I can. I have to produce as much as I can. I have to make a difference, make an impact, and all of these concepts and notions. But then, okay, so now you have time, right? Now you have time. I had time to finally acknowledge my wrinkles, to acknowledge the changes in my body, to acknowledge my gray hair. I had time to acknowledge I adore psychology. This is natural in me. People always come to me. I've never had to look for a client up till today. Never. I never knocked at anybody's door saying, I'm a psychologist, do you need anything? No. I run a business on referrals only, basically. And it's working and it's spreading, and huge companies, the biggest company in Portugal knocked at my door, and I was like, ah, what? They was like, oh, we want you to come and have a conversation with our board of directors and talk about humanity and change and the future and all of that. I was like, wow. I was like, why? Like, okay, because this is it.
And this is what I love the most. And this is why I ask people at the beginning of the conversation, tell me who you are, because this is a full circle thing. A company, a product, a service doesn't just come up out of nowhere. And that's where when you're reading about someone or they're meeting, they just talk about the company. I'm like, but who is the person behind all of this? And every experience that you painted out so perfectly and so authentically, this is why people come to you, because you are you. You are natural, you're honest, you're engaging. I go, and there's nothing fake about you. So when, that's why I'm calling it out, where using the imposter syndrome and who you are and what you've just described in the past hour and a half doesn't make sense to even use that word when you've been so true to who you are. Whenever, I mean, I don't accept words like that for my interns. So I always tell them, like, stop giving the words powers when you are doing such wonderful things for so many people. But you are so, there was not, I don't do any homework about anyone I'm speaking to, because I know I'm going to talk to you. And everyone is so honest on this podcast. I have nothing to gain to harm you, and you have nothing to gain to lie. Exactly. And yeah, so yeah. I love that these are, it's very clear why you do what you do, because of everything I just heard. Very clear, like super clear. And it's very clear why people say, don't say no to you. And you've always had clients.
Yeah. But listen, there was a time during the pandemic where I felt like, who am I to run a business? Who am I to claim I am an entrepreneur? But then I felt like I've already been an entrepreneur for 17 years. I've never had a boss, almost ever. I worked for the government as it was providing a service. I wasn't employed by the government. They were my client.
Yeah, absolutely.
up till today, I've only worked as a freelancer or as a business owner. So,
and you said it as well, that you have a transferable skill.
Yeah.
That skill that you started when you were younger, when you were at that camp, what you were taught, and you've been bringing it along with you every single place that you've gone. You have a transferable skill, so you can go anywhere.
That's right. I've done lots of things, of course. I've made money with doing very nonsensical things, but they always, the full circle, it's always there, especially psychology. Mm-hmm. It's always there. It's there in my music too, because I make melancholic cinematic music.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I make music with no voice, no vocals, no wording, because I want people to feel.
It evokes, and for me, it's photography. That's my binky. It evokes emotion.
Yeah.
So you may not speak the language, but a smile, music, and a photo evokes emotion. That is one of the things that I love so much about those three things. All right. This is not the last time that we're going to talk. Definitely not the last time that we're going to talk. Mental care is in the forefront, finally, all over the world. Is no longer being shamed like it has been in the past. So this is a good thing. So we're going to have many more times where I will start bringing in people from other podcasts that I've had that specialize in the same conversation. So this will be fun to have you back on for that. But we are going to end right now by asking the final question that I ask of everyone. If you had a personal ask and a professional ask, what would it be? We ask so much for our businesses, but we don't ask for ourselves. So I give you the opportunity to answer the two. So what would be your personal ask? And what would be your professional ask?
Okay, so as a personal ask, I want to connect more with my spirituality, because I have a scientist background and I have a scientist mindset. And recently, actually, since I started a company, which is very weird now that I'm speaking up, I feel a calling to connect with my spirituality. It has nothing to do with religion. It has to do with spirituality. Yeah, so that's I see it in front of me. I think this is my personal ask. So what I ask myself is not only the world, I ask myself to allow it to unravel. And about the business, so what I ask about my business, so okay, I know what I want for my business. I want to surround myself with people who believe in people. I want to surround myself with people who put honesty and vulnerability first. I want to surround myself with people like Inish, like you, and like me, which is kind of lazy, because, you know, Stephen Covey has this saying that I find fascinating, which is, if two people have the same opinion, one of them is probably dispensable, right? You don't need that opinion. But then again, when it comes to work, when it comes to teaming up, I think that I want to be surrounded by people who at least have the same faith in life and in people like I do. So that's what I ask.
Yeah. So I have to say that I agree with you. I was the child that almost got I should have been kidnapped, because I talked to everyone. My parents were like, where is she now? Where, like literally I talk to everyone. Whenever I go to countries, if I'm with groups, they're like, where's Jody? You know where she is. She's either taking a picture or she's talking to someone. I'm like that everywhere I go. I want to hear your story. I just want to be engaged with your story. And on top of engaging your story, what I miss that we don't do anymore or less people do is I want to be engaged with people that think differently than me, because I cannot learn and I cannot articulate my words if I'm only with people that say the same thing as I do.
Yeah. And there's one thing that's, you know, that book called Quiet, her name is Susan, the author. She's, oh my God, I don't remember her name. Anyways, I might send it later to you.
Definitely. I have three books that I recommend to everyone. So if you bring on another one, I look at this is good.
Okay. So what she told, she said she was at a conference of the, you know, the House of Beautiful Business organization.
No.
Oh my God, I'm going to fall in love with it. Yes. Anyways, Susan was there and she was talking about her book. Her book is called Quiet, and it's about how introverts have a place in business and have a place actually in the world of.
Yeah,
business.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And there was this one thing that she said, and I struggle myself with this kind of a big contrast, because I'm clearly an extrovert, but in my intimacy and in my personal life, I'm very introvert. So work-wise, I have a persona in my personal life I'm very introspective, very melancholic, very stoic, you know? And she said, every time you're speaking, you're saying something that you already know. Every time you're listening, there is a big chance that you're going to learn something. So
it's 100%.
It's relatable with what you were saying, because if I'm only, you know, in the room with people who would like-minded people, with people who think like me, speak like me, and done things that are in the same direction as my own, then I don't want to be the most interesting person in that room.
Yeah.
I don't want to. If I am the interesting person in a room, I'm in the wrong room.
No, absolutely. And also, how we are so, I feel like the world, I shouldn't say that. I feel like a very large majority of people right now in this time that we're living in are walking on eggshells because they're just waiting for someone to lose their temper, and they don't know how to react to that. I'm like, it's okay if they lose their temper if there's a meeting ground.
Oh my God. I have, so I told you I do assertive training. I have a line in my training, which is, when there is yelling, there is hope. Because when you lose hope, you stop speaking, right?
You stop speaking. Exactly.
So as long as the person is yelling, it means she's very desperate to come up with something. She's
in pain. And sometimes it's not even yelling. It's just literally literally verbally saying something with no filter, where I was told by a former colleague, where they're like, Jody, when you're very like, you know, you just say what you mean. I'm like, well, I do, because if I'm opening my mouth, I care. So then I stop talking. And he's like, well, your quiet is more deadly than your
speaking. Oh, yeah.
Well, there's no winning, huh? But yet I do. I go, if I open my mouth, this is my motto. If I open my mouth, I care. If I don't, I don't care.
Yeah.
And my quiet is definitely deadlier than my talking.
And listen, you can actually transfer that to the business reality, because that's also what happens with employees, right?
And even, every day.
Yeah. And even with the managerial positions, between managers, between leaders, some of them just don't care to speak anymore because there is no flexibility. There is no,
they've been beaten down.
Yeah.
And so they're like, what's the point?
Yeah, exactly. What's the point? So once you reach that place in your life and in your mind of what's the point, that's a red flag that you should be very attentive to, because that's an opportunity to either change it or stop complaining.
100%. And on that note, this is why this conversation was like so meaty, because it literally, you designed where you are right now to where you've been and where you're going. So bravo. Well done. Good girl. Yes. Gasha, thank you so very much for taking the time. I mean, I definitely took more of your time, but you were saying so many really relevant, meaty like things that I'm like, I can't cut her off yet. I can't cut her off. So thank you so very much. I look forward to the next time. This was on par, just perfect.
Thank you. I love it.
Thank you. Have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. We're going into our weekend.
Okay. We're going to keep talking, right?
Absolutely.
All right.
To you soon. Bye-bye.
Is on what you're doing, by the way, it is inspiring. Okay.
Oh, keep well, because we take care of people. That's what we do. Yeah. And this podcast is just another thing of, let's take care of the people.
That's true. Even the flawed ones. Yeah.
Well, are they flawed? Are they really?
Yeah, they are. I think we all are. And that's fine. It's a consolation. It's not a tragedy.
it's our super, I find it as a superpower.
Yeah.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Care.